other variations, and they'll be leading us, I think, about quarter to three. Is that correct, Honourable Ms. Humble? Yes. Right. And so I hope that there'll be some understanding. They joined us at short notice to ensure that we could cover a number of areas, and we really do appreciate that. Thank you to both of you back here. Now, I've already indicated that the Deputy Speaker, the Honourable Chinoy, extending his senior presiding officer at the moment in Parliament, is attending to certain matters. He will rejoin us. And as you can see, House Chair of International Relations, the Honourable Baroto, is back in after a short interlude, as it were. Now, that was, of course, the announcement. And I immediately, on that point, went over to and back to the Honourable the Co-Chair, Hans van Baalen.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fels. I will introduce the coming theme, but I just want only to remind that those who come to the European Union for asylum, for refuge, and even those who are not accepted as asylum seekers are protected by our Constitution, European Constitution, by the Convention on Human Rights of the Council of Europe. So no way is without human rights. That things can happen which we don't want to see, that's for sure. Let's work on this closing statement. We come now to indeed the economy. And ladies and gentlemen, when the euro was introduced, the currency, there was only 10 minutes debate in the National Assembly of the Netherlands, so it was on just like that. We had a currency for over 200, 300 years. Everybody said, it's okay. Even in Germany, they had to relinquish the Deutschmark, but they did it in order to get German reunification. So nobody thought of the big problems we have encountered the last 6 years. The Minister of Finance in my country said, even if there would be a problem with a country like Greece, it's a small economy, so it will not bother the rest of the currency zone. We have seen that this was not true. Of course, there are reasons for that, and a man who is much more able to tell you about the background of the economic and financial crisis in Europe and the Brexit, or not Brexit, situation in Greece is Theodore Stolojan from the EPP, former central banker and a man who knows his way in the world of finance. Theodore, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Gerd. I would like to make a summary of what happened in the European Union. As you know, there are 19 countries in the Eurozone and 9 countries members of the European Union but outside of the Eurozone. When the crisis struck, we discovered two kinds of things. One is that each country has its own problems. The second thing was that, okay, within Eurozone we have some weaknesses. Some of them were known, but some of them were unknown. Actually, what happened? The good news now is that European Union is back on those. Countries which were with big problems like Spain, Portugal, Ireland, they recovered. The bad news is that, okay, the growth is not high enough, and unemployment is still a big issue for several countries in the European Union, and especially unemployment for young people. What we have done? For countries, members of the European Union, which are not in the Eurozone, the agreement of the European Union has an instrument how to support them when these countries are in financial distress. Actually, the European Union can lend this country under different programs of restructuring and so on to put the finance in order. But what we knew was that as a member of the Eurozone, we didn't have any an instrument how to deal with a country in the Eurozone in financial distress. Because when Eurozone appeared, we had a monetary union, but we don't have a fiscal union, we don't have a fiscal capacity, what we call, in order to support a country in financial distress, how is the case with a federal state like United States or a Germany, when a state is in trouble, then the federal budget can support the state, of course, with the restructuring program. Therefore, what happened? The member states of Eurozone created a mechanism outside of European Union agreement. It was an intergovernmental agreement. And today, for instance, we have an instrument which is called European Stability Fund, which is not under the rules of the European Union, but under the agreement between member states from Eurozone who participate with their public money to create this instrument, European Stability Fund. And we will discuss a little later, because it's linked to what is happening in Greece today. Then, therefore, on the one hand, we created such kinds of ad hoc mechanisms in order to support countries like Spain, like Portugal, like Ireland, like Greece. On the other hand, the European Union understood that we should work further to develop this European project. Actually, there were a lot of regulations adopted in order to strengthen the financial sector, and not only financial sector, but to supervise, to coordinate much better economic, fiscal, budgetary policies of the member states. And we created such kind of regulatory framework in which all member states and the European institution are looking to each member state what kind of policies intend to develop, what kind of disequilibrium they are in each member state, and they are together, they are deciding that we should move in this direction or we should move in another direction. We change also our strategy in European Union. Of course, we are following growth and creating jobs. We have a strategy, European Union strategy 2020, and of course, it was a huge work in order to develop what we should do in the future in order to consolidate and to deep integration within the European Union. We are talking about banking union, which is the most advanced part of this project. We are talking about economic union, for instance. You know that we have our common market, but we don't still have, for instance, energy union, and we want to create an energy union also in the European Union. Therefore, European Union, you know, has a small budget, common budget, which is 1% of GDP of the member state. And this budget is supporting implementation of the European Union policies. It's not a budget to support financially countries in distress. Now, as I said, the good news is growth is back. And it's good news also for South Africa, because we are partners in trade, in investment, and so on. Bad news is that we still have a country in financial distress, but in big financial distress, which is Greece. Where we are now is Greece. Yesterday, the Greek Parliament approved the second part of the reform package, which is a precondition to start negotiations between European institutions and IMF, International Monetary Fund, with Greek government for the third, let's call, financing package, about 86 billion euro. This is a financing gap calculated for Greece for the next 3 years. Actually, there were other two programs concluded with Greece, which in a way or in another way were not completed. Actually, some of the reforms were implemented, some of the reforms were not implemented. On Friday, tomorrow, the negotiations will start between Greek government and the representative of European Commission, European Central Bank, and IMF. They will start negotiating now a concrete program, concrete measures. What is interesting is that yesterday the Parliament approved, as I said, the second part of the reform program with a vote of opposition, because part of ruling party, Syriza, they don't agree with this new agreement between European institutions and Greek government. You know, there is a political party in power, Syriza, and this political party doesn't like many people, austerity, doesn't like a program which requires to cut, to regain equilibrium, actually to put your house in order, because the Greek government, not especially this government, Greek government in power, but it's a long history of mismanagement of public sector. And I want to tell you that we are neighbor, my country is neighbor, Romania, Bulgaria, Greece. And we have the same situation in Romania. In Romania, in order to get out from the impact of the crisis, decline of output, we had the same mistake. We increased the salary for public sector in only 2 years by 100%. And we were obliged to cut the salaries in all public sector by 25%. And wanted to cut also the pension by 50%, and Constitutional Court said, you are not right to cut. Don't touch the pension system. And we increased the VAT from 19% to 24%. We had 2 years of recession, but growth came back to Romania. It was very hard for Romanian people. We cut also all social benefits by 15%, but it was the only way to regain macroeconomic stability, and based on macroeconomic stability, to regain the confidence of investors and to regain the growth. It's exactly what we are asking the Greek government, is to take the measure to put their house in order first. Of course, the debt of Greece so high that it's very hard to believe that they can repay this debt according to the schedule of payment which is today. Therefore, you know, when you discuss a debt, there is a debtor and a creditor. And sometimes is not due to only that cause. It's also a part of the problem, is also the creditor, because the creditor gave a lot of the money to a country in financial distress. Therefore, even IMF is believing that in order Greece to recover, there is such kind of relief needed. The problem is that now most of the debt of Greece is not to private sector, but to public institutions. And public institutions are working with public money. And for instance, for Germany, in order to accept now again any relief regarding the debt, and not only relief, but to accept the link to give financial support to Greece, so Germany has to go to German parliament and to explain to parliamentarians why is a need to support again the Greece. Because now I'm coming back to that mechanism created by a member state of Eurozone outside of European Union treaty. It's European Stability Fund. From this fund, Greece will borrow money now. And this fund means public money. Public money of member states of Eurozone. We have good news. Good news are that Greek Parliament approved the reform package. Now is a stage of negotiations. We hope that the Greek government will implement all these reforms, and we have already public statements of different important political leaders in the European Union, including the Chancellor of Germany, who declared that, okay, we are ready to give a relief, but relief not so in cutting the debt, but we can extend maturities. We will see how kind of relief will be result of these negotiations. I'm optimistic that Greece will recover. There are many things to put in order in Greece. For instance, I can give you just an example. The shipping industry is not paying taxes in Greece. Shipping industry doesn't pay taxes in Greece because that is, they said, if you put us to pay taxes, we will take our ships and we will register in another part of the globe, of the world. You know? Yeah. Okay. You can accept or you cannot accept such kind of behavior, but when you think about your country, you can understand that without reforming financial sector, public administration, and so on, things cannot go further. This is in short where we are. And we hope for the best.
Thank you, Kolikolian. Maybe there are others who want to intervene. At least I would like to make some quite political remarks. If Greece would not be in the Eurozone, we would not bother whether they have too many civil servants, whether they have big state debts, or whether they are an export economy or not. I mean, that would be their own business. If you join an hub with quite strict rules on budget deficits, on state debts, on inflation, on, let me say, how you deal with debt, about pensions, etc., you have to be able to set the rules and also to implement them. And the problem with Greece, and to another extent also other countries, it's very difficult for them to do so. I think this is the last chance. I mean, we have two tranches of support given to them, This is indeed the third one, more than 80 billion euros, and they have to do what they sign for. That is not austerity, that, I mean, this is to improve the position of Greece. Otherwise, it will be impossible to defend it in the German Bundestag, also in the Dutch parliament, probably in other parliaments. And we have helped Greece, also our own interest, and that our banks wouldn't collapse, that's all true. But I think that Greece has to live up to the conditions, and they have to become more an export economy. And Greek people outside Greece do great. I mean, you can't, they have shops, they have whatever, they are in business. So I think that everything has been put in place, but now it's implementation.
Including a special program committed by European Commission about 35 billion euro investment in Greece, which are supporting the other part of the money which is designed to cover financial gap. The outside of financial gap, which are discussing about 86 billion euro, 86, the European Commission committed 35 billion to support investment in Greece.
Other colleagues who want to comment on the subject, if not, Kuchera, I'll give you the floor.
Thank you very much, Chairman Barlow. That certainly has given us a factual position there. What we would like to do is just before the Honourable Hadevi leaves, you remember I indicated he's leaving for another meeting, allow him to comment.
All right, thank you, Chairperson. The story I said is like I said before, as well as South Africa in 1994, where the apartheid was a public deficit. That's why you cannot penalize those companies if you're dealing with apartheid, because we will penalize our own people. I think the similar situation with Romania. It's amazing. And then but I think what is critical is the issue of the elderly. Of Greece, really, it was really pathetic to see old men and women who work for the rest of their lives, so that in the twilight of their lives, even that they cannot even gain access to their own man, to their own money. It was very sad indeed, to look at that. I'm very happy that we're also very happy for the EU that the Greek Parliament was able to pass that bill yesterday, because I think that it brings the fresh money into the economy so that the economy can go forward. But what I'm interested in is that when formed this union, what due diligence did you do about the various countries? What was worrying me is what Chairman Barlow said, that if it is only to get 10 minutes to ratify the stimulus to me and the consequences thereof, then the issue was also in Africa, we might be in a similar situation because you can see that there's a free trade that. The agricultural free trade area, were aspiring to have a continental free trade area. I think even in Europe, started like that, in a bit by bit, and then eventually wanted it. Someone would want a union at the end of the day, but we don't want the people's issue of experience. So, on the side of when the union was formed, what due diligence did you do to the various economies and the relevance of the various countries to ensure that you don't see it during the recession, that is a problem. Because when you can look at Greece now, it levels around 177% to each GDP. It's going to take almost a lifetime to pay back that money. So what can you tell us that if you go for the international system in Africa, what are things which you must do best before we can even contemplate a union of that nature? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Waters.
Thank you. Just an honourable Nadine's remarks. I mean, there's a big difference between a free trade zone or common market, as it was called before, and a common currency. So, and then you might go look out for the pitfalls if you ever do go down that road. Just on some of the issues that were raised, it was very interesting to hear that the honourable Dornian, I don't know, that's how you pronounce it, sorry, your surname. He said he doubts whether Greece would ever be able to pay back its debt. I mean, that's quite a very striking comment to make. given that you've just loaned them 80 odd billion euros, and the tension that it's caused in Europe, and in Greece itself, and in Europe generally. I mean, the fact is, what would the consequences be if they couldn't repay the debt? It's a default once more. I mean, it all seems a bit irresponsible, if I may say it that way. Loan someone, I understand you have to loan them money to get them up there. The Philippines, but if you loan them such huge amounts of money, you think they can't pay back. Isn't that irresponsible in itself? So if you could just maybe unpack that. You also talked about the mismanagement of the public sector. That's why they're in the financial trouble they're in. But sure, and also the Honourable, or Hans, if I call him, mentioned that once you join the club, the certain rules that you have to play by. But obviously Greece weren't playing by those rules. I mean, you said the strict rules regarding deficit and pensions, etc. But obviously, there seems to have been a lack of accountability or oversight over Greece in order for them to get to this predicament in the first place. Right? So you said there's a mismanagement of the public sector, yet there was no oversight of them. So how are you going to ensure that it didn't happen in another country? Let's take a radical example. Let's take Germany. There's no one from Germany here, so I can use them as an example. I don't want to offend anybody. So let's say Germany falls into the same predicament as Greece. I mean, what steps are you going to take to prevent them from getting in the first place? Thank you.
Very much, Honourable Waters. I think that, you know, look, despite the crisis that has been experienced, there's no doubt that South Africa does retain very cordial relations with Greece, especially in manufacturing and agriculture, which is a critical area for South Africa and its products, its produce. But I think just think to something the Honourable Debbie raised, but also the Honourable Waters, is the issue around the integration issue of common market and so on. What are the implications of a Greek crisis? That's not one crisis, it seems to be a series of crises for Africa's integration. Because it makes us, we're currently pursuing regional integration, but perhaps in an entirely different configuration and architecture. But you spoke about Ms. Honourable Stolian, about the banking, or the finances, etc. And I asked myself, you know, you had some absolutely top financial people in the European Union and the banks, etc. You laid down very strict fiscal targets. And yet, I cannot understand how with all the oversight that you conducted, you never see this. It reminded one of the Enron case in America. It was unbelievable that could have been seen. And that's what puzzled us here. And it does show up, well, look, what do we do to avoid a similar thing happening in South Africa and so on? But we would certainly hope that rather than a linear model, we begin to pursue something broader than that. And I must echo and underpin the points made by the Honourable Khadeli about the poorer people who bore the brunt and who are continuing to bear the brunt, the vulnerable, perhaps one should say. I heard just, I think it was last night or the other night, how young women, are just abandoning their ladies wholesale. They can't afford to look after them. And of course we do have, and we have experienced similar things in our own country with very young girls, that's all you can say, not women, who don't know what to do with the little one there and abandon that little one. It's almost a Dickensian model and so on. Now, I'm sure that's not where Europe was intending to go with this. So it would be helpful. We've heard the financial side, and that is important. We know only too well. But, I mean, develop your financial fundamentals there in Europe. Where is the human face? Where is this humanity? You offer humanitarian aid to countries outside of the European Union. And I think we're looking at that and saying, is it not something that could be done? Because I, honestly, Lee, when I heard the figure you mentioned, Arnold Stolian, I couldn't believe it. I find it very difficult to even imagine that we could pay this back. So it is a worry, and I have a financial background, an economic one, and it's a real, real worry. So, as you yourself, co-chair, if you could just help us understand this a bit better.
Fine to understand this ourselves, but I first give us a story on the board, and I will make sure the commands are careful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very hard questions coming to me and to our delegation. But let me to tell you a few things. First of all, rules. Several rules. But the rules were broken first by Germany. Because there were rules to not have a fiscal deficit over 3% of GDP. But when was the problem to respect the rules, the first two countries were Germany and France. They didn't respect the rules, they asked for waivers and so on, and actually it was a period of time when the rules were there, but the rules were not implemented. Coming back again, don't forget that there were 10 years of, let's call, golden age of Eurozone. After the introduction of Euro in 1999, 10 years, the financial market, international financial market, per capitalists, they considered Eurozone like a monolith. And they pumped the money into the countries without looking too much at the individual situation of each country. And Greece could borrow money 10 years almost at the same interest rate and risk cost as Germany. Because of that I'm saying, when you talk about debt, you have debt load, but you have also credit load. And this reality will be taken into account in these negotiations between Greece and creditors. Now, we enforce these rules within European Union and especially in Eurozone. We created a mechanism we call European Semester. It's a process within the member states are looking at each other, what kind of policies they are doing, they are intending to do, what kind of measures they have to take in order to respect the rules, to remain in certain limits regarding fiscal deficit, regarding debt to GDP, regarding economic balances. For instance, Germany, it was a general claim that Germany do not increase too much consumption, has a huge annual excellent in trade balance, and other member states are telling to Germany, it's time to increase your consumption. It's not only weak countries, let's say, weaker countries, targets. There are also countries like Germany, which year by year has a surplus in trade balance. How to correct this equilibrium also? We have stricter rules now and stricter enforce mechanisms built during this crisis. Regarding public administration, that was the situation in Greece. Unfortunately, public administration had a lot of problems, not during this current government, during many governments in place in Greece. Excess of stuff, high cost, excess social benefits, for instance, they cut a certain pension. You have 30 months in a year, they had also certain pension. They had such kind of benefits like working with Xerox, you receive an additional money for working with Xerox machine. No? There is such kind of excesses which have to be put in order. And that is what, I mean, European Union now is not asking the Greek government to cut salaries or to cut pension. It's not this case now anymore. It's a case of reforming the economy, reforming public administration and so on. Mrs. Chair, you mentioned social problems, humanity. It's important. But don't forget, Greece, it's a developed country. Greece GDP per capita in 2014 was 16,300 euro per capita. After the crisis, after 5 years of crisis and declining of output. 16,300 euro per capita in 2014. Romania has 7,500 per capita. And South Africa in 2014, according to the World Bank, was $6,475 per capita. We are talking about a developed country. We are not talking about high-income developing country like South Africa or like Romania. Of course, when you have wealth, it's not easy to go down. But there is a price to be paid. We are ready to support the Greece. And I want to tell you, without the intervention of the European Central Bank, the Greece could be down now. Totally down, because the European Central Bank, without any kind of package, allocated 90 billion euro just in order to cover the running of cash from the banking system in Greece. We are talking about 90 billion euro because it was a running. Everybody tried to move its money from Greece to another country. That was the situation. And as our chair said, and I fully agree, without solidarity of the European Union, the situation of Greece was really unbelievable bad. I'm sure that after negotiation, which will start on Friday, we will arrive to a good agreement. We lost six months. I don't want to discuss why we lost 6 months, but we lost 6 months. That is the reality. And during these 6 months, the situation of Greece went from bad to worse.
A great deal on Greece, but I just wanted to put in, you know, countries right across Europe have suffered in the financial crash of 2008. Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and certainly their economies around. The UK also, now these figures are about 6 months old, so they're three of the largest tranches of money that's been thrown at Greece. But we have a population of 65 million. Greece has a population of 11 million. Our debt per capita is £3,000 more than every Greek. that's how much the UK is. I mean, we're lucky that we have an economy that is actually turning around so it's not costing us so much to borrow the money, but we owe also a huge amount of money. And that probably is in the country, I'm not sure what Germany's debt is like, but there isn't a country in Europe that wasn't affected in some way and some measure, and it's kicking an awful lot. So, apropos of the conversation earlier, I was asking your aid, and you know, maybe this is getting into context.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just wanted to make a very brief comment on the issue of public sector, public administration, as Honorable Wolf raised it. And I want to underline what my colleague has said. It's not about cutting, it's about reform. This is a very crucial, a very important point from my view. Public services, as you mentioned, Germany, but I think I know your situation is similar, they are functioning very well. Public services are very important, and I think you know the view from the situation in your country, very important for companies, for the people, from health to education, from, you know, from the regional and local level, from water supply, waste management. We need the public services, and they are in the interest of the citizens. So it's not about cutting the sector, it's about reforming. I think issues like corruption or lack of transparency or other issues put much more into the focus than the question of ownership. The problem is not who owns an enterprise, public or private, or public-private partnership. The question is efficiency. And on the other hand, we see in Europe privatization failings in many, many cases, not in all, of course, but especially in sectors of public needs, of public interest for the people, maybe in the transport sector, but also others. And so we really have to be careful to be precise when we're criticizing public sector and public administration. We must not criticize the ownership as it is, but how inefficient it is. But public services are very important for the people. And one last mark on this, because I'm very thankful to Ms. Peter that, and other speakers that said that also other European countries broke the rules, let's say like that. Most part of the debt of Greeks appeared after the crisis, and because austerity measures, I think it was austerity measures, were implemented by the Troika. So the debts in the beginning were very, very much lower, much lower, then it then came, in German we say Teufelskreis, I don't know the right word in English now, a circle level, then circles, saying delicious circles, yeah, so this is what I wanted to say.
Very short remarks is, the euro, the currency union, was a political project. It was not monetary, not economically. It was simply that France could only accept German reunification if it would do away with the Deutsche Mark, which was the dominant currency in Europe. I mean, my country was affiliated to the Deutsche Mark. The moment the central bank in Germany did something, we responded within one nanosecond. And everything was okay because we had the same kind of political, economic culture concerning debts and so on. So there was not a problem to this. But for political reasons, the currency union was created, and the big mistake, and if there's something to be learned by other countries or regions, is that you have to have more or less the same phase of economic development. You have the same idea about what is the role of the national central bank. You have a little bit the same idea how social partners, trade unions, big industry and government have to work together. And if you don't have this, either you accept that you will subsidize a certain country forever because you think it should be in this political union, like some states in America, and they're subsidized forever. If you can't do this, don't create a currency union. The same is if you want, for instance, for Southern Africa to have a political union, then all the countries have to have a democratic way of governing. They have to be the rule of law, independent courts, independent judges. If you don't have this, it doesn't work. And then it's better to stick with free trade area or let's say more loose forms of cooperation. But I think that the members of the Eurozone have accepted it is worse that we would abandon the Euro or even a Grexit, because you don't know what the consequences are. So therefore, after immense high-sea negotiations, this package for Greece has been made and will be negotiated from now on. But I think, indeed, if it doesn't produce results, the Grexit cannot be avoided. I've always said, but that's not a majority opinion in Parliament, we will never get back the loans. So I can't say it outside this room, but it will not be repaid. Maybe partly, maybe in the far future, but it's well spent if the Greek can reform, if it becomes a normal Western European country. Then you can say, even to electorate, okay. Otherwise, you cannot sell it. And again, what I hope is that that Greece will benefit from it in the end, as we will do. And that is still a possibility. And let's hope.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Co-Chair of Parliament. I think, look, this is an issue that has seized the minds of a number of us internationally and in this partnership. But I think that we would have to agree perhaps to tolerate and see what transpires, you know, and keep each other briefed and informed, because I think it does underline the importance of establishing financial fundamentals and, in fact, firming them up and respecting them. And that's really what that is showing, the danger of, you know, some members not defaulting, ignoring some of these, but sometimes if one has the size of a partner or member, sometimes means that they are allowed not to respect all the rules for whatever the reason in any country or membership or whatever. But I think yes, we do understand that we have our own challenges in that regard, as you are aware. But thank you very much, and perhaps Co-Chair, you may wish to just take us briefly on to, we've almost crossed into that, the integrity of the European Union, etc. We've virtually done that, but if, you know, you want to just conclude it before we move to the current economic continuum on page 2.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask our first vice president, Mr. Zara, to give his comment on this position. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't have a difficult task, because you started to discuss the impact of the Greece situation to the European integration as a whole. I can summarize it in a very, very short way. I think the problem of the European integration is that it's on the halfway. It's absolutely on the halfway. That is the question, that it is the political project, and not all the things which are very, very typical for a normal working state, they are not created until now. That means we are in the half of the way, and there are a lot of powers which are growing back to the national states on the one hand, and to the federation on the other hand. And that is the tension which is now inside the European Union. That is the problem which explains a lot of things. For example, Mr. Schäuble from Germany, he was pushing a little bit for the Grexit, that the Greeks are going to back the drachma and to make a devaluation. And the devaluation is a very, very, very simple way. That means there will be not necessary to make reforms, because the budget of the families or the pockets of the people are going automatically 30% or 40% down. That's a very, very simple way. But there is the pushing from the other powers in the European Union, and they say, no. We don't want to reach it, because we want to make a step to federal arrangements in the European Union, and to express it in a very simple way. It means mutualize the debt. the mutual aid is the best. That means we can create some special mechanism for it. Maybe there was the proposal for the so-called Eurobonds. Eurobonds as a tool how to mutualize the debt. And that was the most important mention in this moment. Are we going to the model of the United States of America, for example, or are we coming back to the maybe trade area and maybe a common market and not nothing more? And there is questions, because look at the United States of America, that is not a problem. You have a lot of countries in default. That is not a problem when Wyoming is in default because the federal government is paying automatically the debt. It would be a bigger problem than the Texas or California is going, but it's nothing special, because the debt is mutualized, and that means on the federal level this debt is solved. And it has no impact on the dollar. Maybe when it's a very big country like California, can a little bit push the dollar on the low level currency in the value. That means that is the same problem. We have now a lot of mechanism, which my colleague Stolajan described in. And but I think that all are, so I call it some supporting mechanism. There are supporting mechanisms, for example, there are big mechanisms, for example, the fund for the financial stability is 500 billion euro fund. That is a big fund which was created to support not only some small country like Greece, but maybe when there will be a bad situation, not in Germany as Mr. Waters said, but for example for Italy or Spain, the fund will be able to support the economy. Now there are all some supporting tools, but there is no enormous mechanism, economical mechanism, which is difficult for the federal country. But we have a common currency. That is a typical federal or unitarian model, but we don't have a real economical mechanism on the level of the European Union as a whole. Especially on the Eurozone, for example, we need one finance minister, we need one common economic policy, because how you can have one currency and you have 19 different economic policies. We have 19 different taxation systems. We have 19 different social systems. That's the pension system and the other affiliated things. And now is the questions, and that's open questions, which will be the next step in the European Union, to the federalization or next to the nationalization. That is the questions and the challenge we are facing at the moment.
And this is very relevant. Just after the Second World War, I think that the majority of the peoples of Europe would have opted for a federation, federal union, United States. You probably know that there would have been a defense union. Well, that's the most political union you could even have, with a European army, etc., but it was not accepted in the French Senate, so it was killed. If you look today, if you will ask the population in most member states, they will say, well, we want to cooperate, yes, but not on this, not on that, not on that. So there is not a thriving feeling amongst the population that there should be a federal union. Maybe even in Germany, it's most people, because Germany, after the Second World War, was the Heller stated, it could join the Council of Nations because there was the European Union or what was before them. They could have done it as Germany. So there's still, what you can be negative about this, it's not my party, but at least you need everything possible to keep the Greeks in. And Schäuble maybe played a role also for the home audience. I don't know exactly, but probably that was the harsh Schäuble and the more mother-in-like Merkel. And you can, in order to achieve a federal union, only go further if the people really want it. And of course, politicians who believe in the federal union can advocate it and be on campaign, but I'm not so sure that they would get many votes. That doesn't mean that I believe we shouldn't advance in European integration, but I think that it's only possible step by step. For instance, we have now a straight relationship with Russia, let me say this, and it's very neutral. And some more defense cooperation amongst the people is acceptable, that's my view. A year or two ago, it was not acceptable. If you speak about common asylum policy, immigration policy, if you see what happens in the Mediterranean, the disasters there, the human disaster, but also the people get into the European Union, maybe at some instance people will say we have to do this again. So also integration in Europe is done by events, by facts on the ground, and not so much on ideology. So I'm not negative. I believe that we can overcome this financial crisis. But it should be better for the people. I mean, if the people don't want it, we don't get it. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, indeed, you know, when we look towards regional integration in South Africa, these are things we're looking at. You know, we all need to learn lessons from what has already been tried, as well. And when one looks at Europe, the reference made to Russia and the tensions there, the reality is gas from Russia. You know, so the issue of that form of integration, you still have the economic arrangement to a degree, notwithstanding there may be other sanctions. And I think that we would certainly want to explore those ideas of a looser rather than a tighter form of integration that one would explore from South Africa's point. But if you allow the Honourable Williams to come in, sir, for a comment, or you can go with Honourable Waters first. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Interesting comment was made about having 19 different economic policies and different policies with regards to social policy, pensions, etc. And if you are to move forward, I suppose in the long run, you're right, you need one coherent policy in Europe going in one direction. But in doing that, you obviously face, I suppose, the challenge or the prospect, for want of a better word, of certain members leaving Europe, the EU. I mean, and now, I think the UK have Catherine rolls her eyes, but it's true. I mean, they currently want to negotiate their terms and conditions in the EU. And put it to a vote, and if anything like this was to come up, I'm not saying it's happening now, but in future years, it probably would push them out of the EU. So that's just a comment I make. But you know, the issues you raised about if you were to move towards a common, effective EU zone in SADC, that we would have common ground on many issues, and ranging from human rights to judiciary, free speech, free press, etc. And it's good that you raise that because in the back of our minds we need to make sure that we don't fall into the ends of pitfalls, potential pitfalls that are there, and that we do, you know, whatever happens, we don't know what's going to happen, but the fact that that we're all aware of what is needed as far as basic principle and understanding are concerned. Thank you
very much, Honourable Waters. Let me just come in here. I think this was it, you know, early on before our cocktail lunch, as it were, we spoke about extremism, migration, and issues like that. And yet, there is a linkage in integration. To a certain degree, when you have a common union, a regional integration, an element, you give up an element of your sovereignty, of your national sovereignty. That's the reality. And put it this way, perhaps the British did not want to lose that element of the financial side of it, especially it became apparent that they didn't quite share the same views it seemed to others of us in South Africa as a number of other member states in the European Union, and you know, decided not to link entirely that closely on that front. Now, the thing, an early issue, comes about when do you. If you've got, you refer to it, Honourable Van Baalen, the co-chair, a club with rules. You decide to join the club with rules. But even within clubs, as we know, issues change. They evolve. into little blocks and groupings, depending on where you stand. And it all comes back, I think, to what one interpreted here from certain perceptions, that there appears to be, for whatever reason, a resurgence of nationalism. And, you know, it reminds one of the League of Nations, you know, everyone was terrible war and so on. They get together in the war, you know, we all agree, there's no rules and whatever. And very soon self-interest came in. One sees this again. One sees this in the United Nations. Great thing to have, you know, not another war like this issue. And already we see, again, changes, self-interest. And I think, you know, in the next 4 years or so, one may wish to pursue this and unpack it a bit more. What are the implications here? What is it that we want? And what is it that we have to get a job? Or as they say in economics, what are the trade-offs? You know, if I want this, what must I give up? And so on. And it is a very difficult issue, conundrum, to get around. And I don't think this afternoon we'll even get through that one, regrettably. But one thing is certain, I'm sure that the member states in Europe would like to see the integrity of Europe, the European Union, retained, broadly speaking. And we here in South Africa, seeing ourselves more and more as Africans, part of the continent, we would like to see greater integration, and yet we know there's the money, there's the customs, there's the things. There's just so many challenges that you wonder how far, how quick, how loose and how tight such integration or regional integration should look like. So we are learning from those who've gone through this experience before. And you certainly have over the years made great strides in many areas. And we certainly look forward to seeing the resolution of Russian tension there, arising out of Ukraine, migration issues, even in our own country, which all link up, as I think you agreed, co-chair, to elements of extremism and the challenges thereof related to human rights and sovereignty and so on. But thank you so much, co-chair. You know, it's been a very frank discussion, I must say, that we have shared. And I see us moving forward in the years ahead that we have this partnership. But it does appear as if we have, you know, finally got to where we should have got to before lunch, and that we begin to start on trade. There's some people itching to comment on trade, their ethos and so on, you know, can't wait. And I think the ambassador on the other side, Ambassador Root, will agree when he came when I first tuned the focus group, the ethos was a red rag to a bull. You could barely mention the word ether, and people, you know, what's everyone's jumping around, and your parents were jumping around, and so on. And now we come today, the ethos. It's a very relaxing afternoon debate.
I think we must give Casimir just a few minutes to elaborate on the issue of migration, because we shouldn't do away with it. I think that a few words from our heart will be spoken, and then we come to the harsh realities, I think, of the e-bus, etc.
Well, we did speak earlier before lunch about migration, and we had an interesting debate on that, but I think possibly time is short, maybe we should go straight into the trade. But if you'll forgive me, Michelle, perhaps I'd better talk about the referendum. I just want to do that, because I know that's of interest. But it's pertinent to this discussion that we've just had on whether we have further integration or not. So we are facing a referendum in the UK on whatever negotiations our Prime Minister can do with his colleagues in the rest of Europe. For me, that's a great transition because I think Albania is stronger in the European Union, and it will be a fight for all of us to make sure that we can persuade the public to do that outside the European Union. From the perspective of Southern Africa, it seems crazy that we would take ourselves out of that big trading bloc and go and stand alone. But it is going to happen, and we're waiting to see what the negotiations will bring forward. So I'm sure you will all be watching with interest from here. If anybody would like to come and help me fight to make sure that we stay in, I will happily put you up somewhere and help to fight. But it is going to be very interesting. It's the other, it's the flip side of trying to keep Greece in when you have a certain number in the public. It's only about 30% of Greeks at the moment that want to leave, but there are a lot of donors in the middle. But it's just a topic. But I'm sure there's so much to talk about trade. I think
you're right. I switch to Zala, and then we return to Mrs. Phelps.
So shortly, I'm sure that the United Kingdom will remain part of the European Union, because if I may say that petty malices that when the UK is coming out from the European Union, that is the end of the UK, because it will split, because the Scottish people are deciding to be a part of the European Union, and not only that, they want to be a part of the Eurozone. As the other countries, because despite all the things we are speaking here, the many countries still are interested to be a part of the Eurozone. For example, the Baltic country, the Scotland, the other countries as well, like Poland or later Hungary and Czech Republic and the other countries. I hope that I will be unhappy because the United Kingdom is something like a hand of the European Union in the world politics, and I think that is very, very important for us, because continental politics is a little different from the Atlantic politics, and the UK is the representative of the Atlantic politics, and can support the Euro-Atlantic relations. I like the notion of Euro-Atlantic relations, not the Atlantic relations. And that is why I don't like when my colleagues sometimes speak only about the Western Europe countries, because now the European Union is more European than Western European, and I am very proud that we have a majority in the European Union, and we can change what we want when we are cooperating together. My last about the sovereignty. My colleague said rightly, but it was a metaphor that we are a club which must stick to the rules. In reality, we are a semi-state. We are a semi-state, not decided if we are coming back to something like confederation or to the federation. That is open field, but the last word is sovereignty. I remember in my country in the 90s, when we were not a part of the European Union, we didn't have any sovereignty, because the real sovereignty had the monopolies and the investment funds in the world, and our Prime Minister was not able to decide in whatever, nothing, because when the people which had in the hand the capitals, they I called it the strike of the capitals, that they say, okay, then we are going out from the country, the Prime Minister must give up. There was not other possibility. Now, when we are a part of the European Union, we are stronger. We are really strong, and now we can, at the world level, we can play a real game with the biggest partners. It was never in history, for example, in my country, that we can drop something what was the Germany or Spain or Italy. Now we can. We have a more sovereignty than we ever in history had. And that is something very different when we speak about the sovereignty. We gain the sovereignty, not lost the sovereignty. Thank you.
And Mr. Zala was right. It is not a Western European Union. It is European. Absolutely. Mrs. Hudson.
Yes, thank you very much. Really, that's very, very interesting, Honourable Zala, because to say that as a result of integration, the union itself, it actually feels large loan. Not something I think we were aware of. And of course the issue of Britain, yes, I'm sure the British government are cognizant of it. And so that we do await the results of the referendum in the interest, don't we? Yes.
That if Britain votes, well, to leave the EU, that Scotland will then break away from the UK to join the EU. You shouldn't use that argument in the referendum, because it might encourage a lot of English-speaking people to vote no to leave.
Yeah, interesting, yes, very interesting. But thank you very much, Co-Chair. Shall we move on, Co-Chair, to trade, including the Economic Partnership Agreement? Right. We're going to ask the Honourable Williams here just to take the lead there, and then I think Honourable Mackay, you'd like to come in there. Of course, anyone can come in. Right.
Thanks, Chairperson. If I get to the EPAS, here we go. In the spirit of openness and frankness. Okay, so we all understand what's happening at the moment. Fundamentally, what's happening at the moment is, with regards to the EPAS, they went through a process to clean up the text of the agreement that was signed on the 15th of July, 2014. So they've gone through this shrubbing process, and they've just recently completed it after there were four EPA group internal shrubbing meetings, and then there were three joint EU Southern African Development Community meetings, shrubbing sessions. And fundamentally, we understand that although the EU still has to take these agreements back through their processes, we would like to reiterate that if there's any substantive changes, it's going to be a serious, it's going to have serious implications into the conclusion of those agreements. So fundamentally, during the meeting, the last session of the joint scrubbing that was held in March 2015, during that meeting, the following issues were declared stable, and I'll tell you what they were. They were protocol on rules of origin, mutual administrative assistance in customs matters, protection of geographical identification and related relations between trade development and cooperation agreements for the EPA. So that what we just want to say is that if you go back through your processes and then you start making substantive changes, then we'll be going back to the drawing board again. Further to that, we'd like to try to emphasize, and we can't emphasize this enough, that the EPAs must support regional integration, our regional integration. Because what's happening is, and I'm going to be honest and frank and everything here, you're making deals with some people that are better than deals with other people, and it's causing us problems in integrating our region. So we'd like to try and avoid that. So we should be working closer together to help us integrate our region. And then the last point I just want to make is the importance of market access that comes along with the EPAs mustn't be hindered by the introduction of non-tariff barriers by the European Union. Now, recently, in today's newspaper, in fact, I'm going to quote the Minister of Trade and Industry, who said that stopping the black spots, origin because of black spots, is fundamental protectionist on the part of the European Union. Now, this is just an example of a non-tariff barrier, but the EPAs give us a massive access to the market in the European Union, and then we agree on all of these things, and then you come with things that are not in that agreement but are different, and so it's causing us problems, so we just want to highlight that. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Honourable Williams.
Chair, I've been largely covered by my colleague. Perhaps you should say that I think as politicians we're really trained to talk in generalities. And these sorts of agreements are quite specific, so forgive us if we do bungle along that. There are just two points that I want to reiterate. The first point around the EPAs is that there is a significant deadline which exists for us, the 10th of October 2015 is the joint ratification day. It is significant because of East Africa enjoys customs union, oldest in the world, with surrounding states, Namibia, Botswana, and Swaziland, whose economies are much smaller in terms of their GDP. Their access to the European market is fundamental. Do we miss this date? There is in the more likelihood that these small nations will lose access to the European market with significant impacts on their economy. And we have to emphasize that there is moral obligation that we get this line by the CNA on the 10th of October. My colleague already touched on the need to avoid substantive changes. Far be it from us to talk to you about democratic processes. However, we also re-emphasize the fact that in negotiating these agreements, we have made significant concessions on both sides. We are now in a compromise position that works for both sides. We'd encourage the European Parliament to, you know, act in good faith on what has been agreed and to really just contribute to getting this agreement through the European Parliament as speedily as possible. Obviously, it's understandable that the European Union is going to negotiate the best possible position for itself with its trade partners, as South Africa does as well. However, obviously, we ask the European Union to remain cognizant of the fact that regional integration benefits the European Union as well as the countries that become regionally integrated. We would like to reserve some rights that should, in future, these agreements be deemed and proven to undermine regional integration, that the European Union retain some openness to renegotiating some of those positions in the best interests of not only ourselves, but our regional partners as well as the European Union. I think it's fundamentally important that we get some level of commitment on that. My colleague has touched on one of the non-tariff barriers. However, I just want to emphasize that service seems to be particularly affected by non-tariff barriers at present within the European Union. This has a significant impact on the South African economy. Obviously, agriculture is one of our main areas of production, specifically citrus. And we have to, therefore, re-emphasize that scientific evidence should be used as the basis for any form of exclusion on citrus, specifically relating to black spot, something I've never heard of before today, but that's what it is, as well as the use of a chemical called guarantine. We are a producer of the chemical. It's essentially a chemical used to prevent forms of fungus, I'm hearing. Yes, thank you very much. Fungus. And apparently the European Union is currently considering a policy of lowering those levels. Again, we reiterate that we would like to rely on scientific evidence and negotiate in good faith on what could follow tolerable levels. Specifically because there's an impact for our imports of the actual citrus as well as the chemical industry that's built around supplying this to citrus farmers, etc. Finally, and a big concern for us is potential legislation that the European Union is considering about genetically modified foods and stocks, specifically animal stocks and feedstocks. As you know, South Africa is the ninth biggest producer in the world of GMO, and this doesn't necessarily have a direct impact on our trade relations with Europe, but more significantly in relation to the African countries to which we export in terms of their stock and the animal stock and the products which have been subsequently imported into the European Union. It's a significant potential negative effect for South Africa. And at this point, we are finding the uncertainty intolerable. We need to create some clarity around where the European Union is developing in this regard, and specifically what considerations might be thought of. And specifically, there seems to be a move within the European Union to allow for some level of what I would call, for lack of a better word, regionalization, where each country will be able to determine for themselves the process around GMOs, which we think is not necessarily a bad approach. However, we have seen the European Union refuse to adopt this approach in regards to, again, our citrus black spot problem. So we suggest that if we're going to use it for GMO, it might be applicable to black spots, and you might want to allow countries that don't import citrus or can't produce citrus to allow them to import directly from South Africa. So I think as politicians, we've probably mangled together as much, but those are the key points that we'd like to get across. I have to emphasize that trade should happen in good faith, trade should happen competitively, and in these rounds, we believe that we have a strong case being made, and you know, hope that you might consider to be able and speak to your colleagues within the European Parliament to help resolve this well speedily.
Thank you. Very much, Honourable Mackay. Perhaps the other thing just to add to it, which when I heard about it was a little alarming, in fact, was that four of the assignments, consignments on citrus fruit came back, which created the impression that it was four different provinces all over. It turned out, once it was tracked down in the trail aid, that it actually all came from one farm. And not from you know, all over the country in one piece here. But I think that, you know, the acting EDG in International Trade and Economic Development Division, they just briefly expand on that aspect for us because we have got facts in that regard.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you to the co-chair as well. The issue regarding the Cyprus Black Spot, as articulated by the members, has serious implications for South Africa and has serious implications for agriculture as well. There have been a lot of discussions with the EU at government level to try and resolve this, but we have not been able to find each other. And in 2013, the EU issued a regulation to say that after 5 interceptions, there will be a prohibition or a ban on citrus. In 2014, after 4 interceptions, the South African industry then undertook a voluntary export restraint to try and avoid the ban. And this was at serious cost to the industry. And this is an industry that is labor-intensive, given the challenges that we have with unemployment. Again, this year, we've had a situation where we have been notified a week or so ago that already there have been 4 interceptions, which means that after the 5th interception, we face a ban. The minister has written to the commissioner, Commissioner Malmstrom, to try and ensure that we're able to engage on this because the issue is that the interceptions, as the chair has indicated, are from one farm. So to consider them as 4 interceptions when it is one farm that is affected is a bit, for a lack of a better way, unfair. So there are discussions. We are hopeful that out of those discussions we can then have a permanent solution in terms of how we can deal with this. We have proposed the issue around regionalization, which means exporting to the countries that do not produce, even though we still maintain that there's no scientific evidence that a citrus black spot from a peel can in fact produce. There have been a lot of exchanges with EFSA to try and resolve the scientific basis for the ban. So what we'd like to appeal on is that, as the minister has indicated, that it is affecting our industry, and without a thorough scientific basis, it may be seen as a protectionist measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Waters.
Just briefly, I mean, the citrus industry employs 80,000 people in the country, which is a lot of people. I'm not saying you should, you know, if it was a real health risk, that you should ignore it just because 80,000 people are working in the industry. But the fact of the matter is, black spots on citrus fruit, it is just a cosmetic blemish. There's nothing to affect the health of humans, and it doesn't affect the quality of the actual citrus fruit. So our appeal to you as politicians is to please to make an intervention, whatever you can do once you get home, because it really is affecting, obviously, the livelihood of a lot of people, and obviously the foreign income from the exporting of the citrus fruit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Waters. Let me just conclude on this by saying, you know, one is aware, it's not every country in Europe to which, if I could put it this way, to some economic threat, perhaps is a better way of putting it. One has become aware that, in particular, it would affect Spain, and Spain, of course, producing many very tasty oranges itself, you know, and it's what it can export within the European Union itself. And yes, one is mindful of that. We've heard about it long enough. Some ideas have been thrown around by previous European Union delegations have been, well, you know, you don't even have the same seasons. So why don't you export during this season, you know, your summer season, and leave Spain alone, and then they'll export within Europe during their summer season. Yes, we do understand that. And, you know, obviously, we will continue to explore issues like that. But what the concern, I think the concern we have, parliamentarians, as politicians, is that, you know, once you start down this road of protectionism, it can become a slippery slope, unintentionally perhaps. So one, from our point of view, we would want to be cautious in that particular regard, while continuing to explore these other areas like different seasons and so on and so forth. And we do welcome the help we have received from the European Union when they have come through and assisted with various administrative issues. Yes, we do. So thank you very much on that one.
Thank you, Commissioner Thompson. Also for me, black spots on citrus was a new thing. So also from our side, we look into the matter. You spoke about different seasons, so we should not be real competitors. What I would like to do is first, before I give the floor to Mr. Borrelli, to ask the ambassador, who is the man who knows most of those things because he has dealt with them, to give maybe a short update, and then we come to the more political position of Mr. Borrelli. Ambassador.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much for the intervention by the South African side. And let me start with the citrus black spot and maybe say one or two things later, Chair, also about the EPA. On citrus black spot, I would like to underline in the first place the very cooperative, constructive and professional cooperation with the South African Department of Agriculture and Fisheries. There are two things. In the first place, our ongoing discussion on the scientific merits of the South African position and the European position. And I think all of us, the European side, the South African side, but certainly also Ambassador Nkosi and myself, do hope that our scientists will, in the short term, come to a united diagnostic of the risks that citrus black spot poses to the European production areas. But it is true that in terms of security, human security, there is no threat. The threat is a possible affection of the European production areas, which would constitute a huge decrease in the value of this production. Secondly, we've had a European expert commission earlier this year in South Africa, and they have made a detailed study of the South African treatment of citrus black spot. And they've come up with a very positive report. They said South African systems to fight citrus black spot are in order. The question now, of course, is can these systems be implemented to the full? And I think both for South Africa and the European Union, the four early interceptions, I have to say, have come as a very unwelcome surprise. In the meantime, it has been established, I look at Massimo De Luca, our real citrus black spot expert, that three of the four interceptions have come from the same farm. And without, this is really between us, but we have, I think, good reasons to believe that this farm did not follow the excellent South African approach to fight citrus black spot. So this is certainly something we will have to look into. The point is, as the DDG has underlined, that there is this five interception barrier. As we all know, and Spain doesn't like this, last year, only after we had far over 20 interceptions, the European Union still did not act. And we've been under criticism by our member states. But then, and I think that is a decision that is to be complemented, the South African growers themselves said, something is happening here that we do not understand. So let us stop ourselves. So the South African producers took this decision. We are in very close consultation with the South African producers, and the Department of Agriculture. In fact, we have very frequent joint consultations. And the South African Growers Association, as well as DAF, as well as our experts, say that if the rules are applied according to South Africa's own protocols, we should should be able to avoid as much as possible, you know, further interceptions. So the interceptions that have been taken place now, again, an unwelcome interceptions, and also at a time of Sidrus where we haven't had these interceptions before, they need to be further researched. So that is where we stand at the moment. But I would like to say that professional cooperation between DAS and the European side is at a very high level and very productive and constructive. So the experts say, okay, we disagree about scientific evidence, but we don't disagree on how we have to treat this. So that is where there is focus, and that is where Sidrus Black Spot is seen as a great challenge and not as a problem. Then a quick word on the economic importance of South Africa's citrus export to the European Union. One, it is a big economic interest for South Africa, and in all our dealings with South Africa, also in the EDA framework, we of course see a certain asymmetric element that we accept. South Africa is a market of 50 million, the European Union is a market of 500 million, so you have to filter in certain asymmetries. But secondly, I would like to underline also the economic importance of South African imports in the European Union for Europe. In season, because the alternating seasons are there by definition, because we are all opposing things. And it's only maybe in the shoulders, as they call it, so you see what an expert I have become, in the shoulders of the seasons that there is a little bit of overlap, but quite frankly, it is of no consequence. And the thing is that in season, almost 60% of the citrus consumed in the European Union comes from South Africa. That is a short period, but this is a significant period. And most, if not practically all of the import of South African citrus in the European Union is done by Spanish companies, because they have the established trade patterns, they have the knowledge, and they have links. So there is much more joint interest in this whole question than would meet the eye at first sight. So I would say there is really a joint commitment to solve this, and I really practice myself, and Massimo Luca and myself also in Spanish, at various occasions we said, you know, if there are protectionist considerations, you know, throw them on the table. And I cannot see that at all. It's strange that is imposing. We are fully, fully aware of the great economic importance of South Africa, of this export. In fact, there are 100,000 people, we understand, if you include the supporting industries. We know that, for instance, in Western Cape, there are farms which export 100% of their harvest to the European Union. So there is a shared recognition of the interest, there is shared concern, but it is true that as far as the scientific evidence, there are still differences of opinion. Sorry to go into that much detail, but I think it is important to be as clear as possible. Thank you, Jan.
I would like to give the floor for Mr. Morelli.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm sorry I did not think before, but I would like to thank you, South African Parliament, to welcome us. And I'm really happy to be here. I'm new on this delegation, like I'm new on in the European Parliament. This is the first mandate. I visited your country last year, and I decided to join the delegation because I believe that our continents can work together more and can work better. So just a small political remark in a few words. I think that we need to ratify the economic partnership agreement to ensure growth, to ensure employment, and to ensure investments. We can create a common market with 900 million people. We need to translate the agreement in market opportunities, and to do this we have to improve our business diplomacy to include entrepreneurs in this project, opening our markets. to the rest of the world. And I know that in crisis situation, the behavior is to close the market to an internal one, but I believe that we can exit the crisis only change our minds. So this is the answer to you. Europe is in crisis and a lot of people want to close the market believing this is the only way to survive. But in my opinion, we have to act just in the opposite way. Thank you.
Thank you. And let me say, concerning all the conditions, I've been involved in the Japan, and it took a lot of time, but in the end, the concerns of both sides were taken into consideration. That means that also the South African considerations have to be accepted, and I think that we will work through that, and I agree with you that as soon as we have established that, it will be beneficial for both sides. Are there others who want to say something about foreign trade, the trade relations with South Africa? Yes, unless you want two words, and then this is bigger. On the EPA, I thought you would talk about CBS, but on the EPA, I would like to confirm, and the DDG knows that even better than myself, that we have now received from the South African government the letter in which the minister confirmed that the legal scrubbing issues have been sorted out. Between South Africa and the European Union, DDG, I speak under your control, all outstanding issues have been sorted out. We assume this letter has not been yet written on behalf of the other member states, isn't it? So we expect to copy that letter soon, because also, as far as, I'm a bit optimistic here, DDG, but I think it's fair to say here that a legal scrubbing has been completed and that the process of the initiating can now be transferred in the process of signing and eventually ratification. And as one of your, as one of the members of the South African delegation has pointed out, we have a deadline to meet. I think we can be even more than optimistic. I think we can practically guarantee that that deadline will be met, because the legal, there was agreement, it was signed at technical level. Then we have to do the legal scrum that just like last month is a new topic for many of us. That has been done now. It has been very well scrubbed. And we can now proceed. So as far as I'm concerned, but maybe DDG should also confirm that, as far as the technical level in the European Union is concerned, we are ready.
Just as a comment, really, that I was on the Trade Committee in the last Parliament and also with the ACP, and the sort of ethers have been bubbling along all the time. I've been a member of the European Parliament, and it was very nice to hear quite positive remarks coming back, because in other parts of the world it's not quite so positive, put it that way, and ethers have had a bumpy ride all the way through. But also I was involved with the Invasive Alien Species legislation too that we did in the last Parliament. And you can imagine a continent of Europe receiving goods and trade from all around the world. There is some concern on invasive plants and diseases. And I was slightly alarmed to hear it termed as a trade barrier. I think barriers are sort of constructed methods there. It's more a trade interrupter, because we need to be protecting our own plants and species from other things if we find they're coming in. So I hope that doesn't become a trade barrier in any means, because I think the fact that the EPA is scrubbed and ready almost to go is a really positive and good step forward. So we're very sorry that the disease has really set in. I have that spot on my roses, but I don't have any. It's everywhere.
Well, you know, let me, before I complete my own comments, just indicate before
But you see legal scrubbing. I think, yes, it's about like scrubbing the floor or something, but you can see if it's clean or not. Well, I learned it's not quite that simple. You know, all these legal things, it's in the detail, the devil. And I think what one would like to share with you, fellow parliamentarians, is that it's not in that first text that one looks at, whether it is the English text that you're both working from or not, when I say both, you know, both parties. But then, of course, as we know, in our own experience, comes the translation. Now, you have colleagues who then say, no, hang on, you told us this was okay. Have you seen the Portuguese version? Have you seen this one? Have you seen that one? And then one learns, as one has learned in one's own country during a translation process, that other nuances and perhaps interpretations may emerge. And I think just to allay your fears, that is the only reason why we said, can we sign this off once all these things are done? So we can, you know, is this the interpretation coming from the original document? And that's because of our own experience as well in our own country. But let me ask yourself, DVD, to add that final clarification.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I also just want to confirm what the Ambassador has said. We are very close to concluding the legal scrubbing. We have a final session that we'll meet next week in Brussels just to tie up the loose ends. But just to alert members that there may be just one complication. As Honourable Member McKay has indicated, we are in a customs union with other countries. There is one outstanding issue that relates to Chapter 93, which is arms and ammunition, where in terms of the Trade Development Commission agreement between the EU and South Africa, we trade on those. But with regards to the EPA, the EU is now taking a position to say we do not want to trade on those items with the BLNF, which means different treatment of countries in the same customs union. And what that means is that the EU will be able to export, and those exports will access the whole sub-market, but then one country out of sub will be able to export to the EU. So I just want to alert you, even though we close, there could be that one communication, but we're hoping that it will be resolved next week. Of course, the BLNF have to think about whether they will accept that treatment. But just to say that going forward, what is critical, in line with the fact that whatever trade agreement we have must support industrial, I mean, regional economic integration. So it is important that we understand the dynamics in which South Africa is in, just like the EU, because you are one common market, we are also a common market. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And may we just extend our appreciation European Union for lifting restrictions on ostrich meat. That's gone down very well. Thank you very much indeed. Right. Yes, ostrich farms, you know, they went out of business in the same way that in the previous century when feathers were all the rage and they were doing so well then, you know, that was not being the fashion and they nearly went out of business then. But anyway, right. Co-chair, am I on track then if we shift very quickly to BRICS? BRICS is really just a short piece of information sharing here. What's the snow forward sector? Where are we? You know, you've heard of the development bank and so on. But I think perhaps one of the, what's South Africa? I mean, it was BRIC, as you know. And what offered us the opportunity when it said, please come and join us. We were nowhere near in their league, as you know. Nowhere near. But because we were reindustrializing in South Africa and changing the structure of the economy, going up the higher value chain, we realized that we have to sell our goods like anyone. You produce, you must sell. If you're going to move along with regional integration, then indeed you've got a much bigger market. So if you join BRICS, you totally include that aspect. Yes, we are small in ourselves as a population and as a market. But if we work closer on the African continent, then we become, if you like, to some extent, less of an unequal partner than the BRICS set up. And that for us was one of the big helps in that direction. The other thing, of course, as you know, Honourable Co-Chair, we already had a diplomatic arrangement through Parliament and the country with BRICS when we, and India, you know, and South Africa, we already had that. And what this did was really to bring Russia and China in. And rather than seeing this as one of these factors that may reduce our relationship with yourselves, I think the broader or the more you expand the situation, you actually increase the opportunity for shared relationships between more people. And it reduces the tensions, in fact. And we certainly welcome your own forays into this area, economically speaking, as well. Was always there with Russia, more recently with China. And we're not seeing this in any form of threat, because, as you know, there's always multiplier factor and economics. So we see this as a win-win situation for all of us, in fact. And that's really where we are. We've just come back from the 7th BRICS Summit recently, and one of the members in the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, a colleague of Honourable Mackay and Waters, the Honourable Jordan Hill Lewis, was really, he was saying, great, the opportunities and this and that and the next thing for the BRICS Summit, and indicated that, you know, every time we point to Europe and say, oh, now we can't do this, we can't trade this, we can't trade that, we should leave that alone. I mean, we can't trade with a particular partner. Not see it as an entire risk to our economy, but rather look for other opportunities, as any country does. Again, I believe that reduces tensions as well, as long as trade is there. And that's really what we're hoping for. We hope with the Russian situation and our talks with them, that in so many ways they do have a traditional relationship with Europe, as we do in South Africa. And really one looks forward to an early resolution of the tensions that we know are currently operating in the region. But over to you, Honourable Van Bommel, Co-Chair.
Thank you. Indeed, also we are in favour of diversification, the fact that you take your role in the BRICS very seriously. It's not something which is directed against us. Also for us, it can be interesting. I would like to ask first Vice Chancellor Zala to give his reflections.
Thank you. I will have some remarks only to the relations between the EU and the BRICS countries, because of course the South Africans, they have own strategy and tactics from my point of view, the BRICS is not really organization. It is not immigration assembly or so something. That is only ad hoc coalition of the some countries which from our point of view have very different political, geopolitical and economic interests and very different relations. It means to speak that the BRICS is something what is one body or could be one integrated body, I think it's an illusion, and I'm speaking about our point of view, because there is a dozens of different strategic goals which these countries have as a individual countries, not as a one organization, but the reality is not an organization yet. Take into account that Russia has some very specific strategic and geopolitical interest in the Eurasian. That was the reason why they are trying to establish the Eurasian Union, which is the core of the conflict between the Ukraine and Russia, because the whole conflict started at the moment when the Ukrainian government was not very clear and not very willing to go to Eurasian Union. In this time they were not very willing to go closer to the European Union. That means there was some unbalanced movement between the government, but the most part of the Ukrainian, and especially the citizens, they show that they are in favor of the close cooperation with the European Union. And the Russia didn't want to lose the Ukraine, and they started the conflict in the eastern part and in Crimea, misusing the Russian minorities in Ukraine. That is our point of view from the European. But the result was a declining of the Russian economy, of the ruble, and I think that there is not a very optimistic perspective the next 3-5 years for the Russian economy, because it's based only on the commodities, not on the real manufacturing productions. China is a very big player. Is a really big player which wants to be a part of the international financial institutions or the international arrangement, and they don't want to be out of this arrangement, because there is no reason. They want to operate on the real world level. That is their interest, and they will do that, and they have the power to do that. The Brazil is in, and you could see it the last month, they forged a strategic relationship with the United States of America after the changing positioning of the United States to the Latin America. The situation rapidly changed. That Cuba is only the peak of the iceberg, because that is the global change of the American policy towards Latin America. And they are building the relations with Latin America not on the method of the dominance, but the method of the common interest, and that is a very different way. And Brasilia is the first country which make a very big deal with the United States in this direction. Of course, India has a different, very different strategic interest. On the one side, India is still in the conflict with China, on the one hand, and has a strategic partnership with the United States, especially because of the nuclear energy, because that India has all the support from the United States for the developing of the nuclear energy, and that is something what is vital for the Indian position in the South Asia. I am analyzing this only to show that these countries are always, and they will in the future, follow their own strategic interest and not the integration. In reality, it is not possible because of the geographical different location of these countries as well. And they will never have a power to make alternative financial system to existing financial system. They can play a big game to strengthen their position in the international financial system. Yes, that is a very, very legitimate goal, but not to make something like Russian sometimes dream to make alternatives to the dollar system and the system of the IMF through the banks which were opened last week, if I remember right. I think that will be, and we can support it, and it's absolutely normal that the people and the other countries will use the banking funds for the infrastructure, for the development of the other things, but it's up to every country to count the plus and minuses with this and that is a strategy of every country. But I will finalize my introduction that what is important is to be a part of this game, but not to abandon the other possibilities and shift only to this one direction. That will be, I think, the mistake from every country, from the European Union as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sturgeon, would like to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two comments. The first one is that we should congratulate South Africa because South Africa committed only $5 billion to this development bank, but will have the same voting rights like China, India, Russia, which is very good. I mean, wonderful. Of course, it's a great idea to have a development bank. It will be, there is another development bank between Asia and China. There is one bank we should have development. You know that this year for European Union is International Year of Development. The second comment is, of course, regarding what my colleague said about different interests of each country in BRICS. Ukraine is neighbor of European Union, neighbor of Romania, of Hungary, Slovakia. We are worried about what is happening in Ukraine. I don't say that we have ethnic Romanians who are living in Ukraine. And for instance, they don't want to participate in this war in Ukraine. They said it's not our war. It's war between Russian and Ukrainian and so on. And there are problems. And you know what is much worse? Because of these events, we have to increase our military expenditures in Romania and in other countries. Why we should waste our money for military expenses? But we are obliged now, because when you have such kind of events, unpredictable events, in terms of, to conquest part of the territories of other countries, then you have a problem, and unfortunately, it's not only the problem in Europe. You can see that this sound of military expenses need to increase is everywhere. It's not only in Europe, in Russia, and so on. Thank you.
Well, a country like South Africa has always chosen the path of international law. And I think in order to come to agreements also with Russia, international law is key. And maybe in this case, even you could have this debate with Russia, because we have long-standing relations, as we know, in respect. Again, I return the floor to you.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair. Yes, indeed, you know, there are, you know, an economics control club producing competition, promoting it, etc., in order to bring about a more equitable system and so on. And I think the same probably applies to multilateralism institutions like the Bretton Woods of the IMF, the World Bank, and the United Nations. We've begun to see the transformation. Europe's there, China's there, and the Security Council. And yes, we rely, you know, I think what BRICS does is it offers another way of doing things as a development bank. So, as you quite rightly say, I want to tell you that, you know, there's South Africa with only so much, you know, put into the development bank, and yet we have the same say. It's a more equitable system from our point of view. And I think the Honourable Zara actually said earlier, before we joined the European Union, we couldn't seem to say no to anyone, you know. Apparently, it would hold his rent from us, as it were. And now that we're part of the broader block, there's an equitability about it. So, in many ways, we have more sovereignty. Sally, you know, BRICS offers us an alternative global governance order. World, you know, the World Trade Organization, IMF, World Bank, and the like. And really, what we do welcome is the opportunity to address some of the imbalances that do exist, but perhaps more importantly, for the development of South Africa itself and Africa. We have the opportunity to develop infrastructure on the continent. And I think that can only benefit everyone, not only ourselves, but our trading partners as well. So we do see it as a big plus, and I'm not sure if that was due to our negotiating skills or not. I'm not sure if it's the appeal we got. Thank you. If we could, I see the Honourable Baroto, who was going to lead us here, just pop out. Right, nothing like strategic moment, as it were. But, Honourable Bradley, perhaps you just like to say one or two words.
I'm just going to make a few casual comments, almost as a spectator of the last 16 years, and some of these things. I'm thinking, obviously, there's a lot of debate, particularly with me being on international relations, around national interests and whether South Africa should be more concerned about national interest or values, friends, with all this kind of thing. And South Africa appears to me to have decided that SADC and the AU interest is our national interest. And so that, and we often pass on national interest in favor of regional interest because there's a kind of a decision that those are our national interests. Basically, we've committed to inter-SADC and inter-Africa trade, strengthening the regional cooperation and the sense that that regional strength is going to put us in a better negotiating position. An agreement, and that would be why obviously EPOS was to the issue if arrangements were made with parts of SADC, and we would go on it, but other people wouldn't, and it would just undermine our facility in terms of being able to work together as one on those issues. Trading, of course, primary commodities does not, and this is for all of the regions in Africa, particularly SADC, does not result in economic growth, job creation, and poverty alleviation, and therefore we all have to develop a diversity in manufacturing sector and industrialization. They have to be beneficiated, and we realize it's a collective role, and there are obviously the infrastructure, the working together on trade issues, security and defense. We obviously, our link in terms of SADC and Africa on those issues is huge, and we have to be very careful because obviously in terms of people, South African people are not really very keen to be spending money, unnecessary money on defense issues, but this is our issue and we can't just ignore it. Then we've been very involved in peacekeeping efforts and we've been very effective there, and it wasn't too long ago that we realized that we would go in and be very successful in terms of peacemaking efforts, and then we would move out all very righteously and allow China and everybody else to come in and reap the benefits in terms of investing, etc. So it hasn't been too long that we've actually, too long ago that we realized, almost like a wake-up call, South Africa really needs to take advantage when we do a peaceful situation. We have to take advantage of it in terms of trade, etc. Then efforts to position ourselves in Africa, I've watched over the years for me where there's been a lot of jealousies, and South Africa particularly had to be very clear almost in the sense of not looking like they wanted to be the boss of Africa, and there was a kind of a sense of our leaders trying to position us in a way we weren't offending and being confrontational, and then again more recently deciding, no, We've had agenda, we deal with them. If we don't, so they were skipping forward and lobbying for position and saying we are who we are and here we are, and we'll manage whatever the fallout is. So that's just some of my comments. That's kind of what fly on the wall. Thank you.
Very informed fly. Thank you. Uncle Barotto, you want to participate in this area as well. Yes. On what you discussed with me, yes. Yes. Sorry, thank you. Let me start with the issue of SADC and say that SADC is a 15-member state. And unfortunately, it had met just not long ago, 2 weeks ago, and I remember vividly some of the issues that were discussed. But what we need to know is that there are only 13 member states that participate in the free trade area, and what is more emphasized is more about the infrastructure, because our major products are petroleum, oil, trucks, tobacco, and electric energy, which also need transportation besides just being able to transport from one area to the other. So what we have also seen is that the industrialization strategy also needs to be improved in a way that industrialization and resource beneficiation aimed addressing productive capacity and supply side is constrained through the development of a regional value chain to underpin the intra-regional growth and diversification of trade. And maybe as we talk of that, we must realize that there is this argument in SADC that there are those countries that have better economies than the others. And what is important is for us to help one another, one country, help each country to develop in whatever they have. So there is that coming together, and maybe on SADC as the last thing that I just want to hit on is that in the recent summit, that the parliamentary forum summit that was held, there was a resolution that the SADC becomes officially a parliament, a SADC parliament. But it's something that we still take into our different parliaments so that we are able to push for what it is aimed at doing. So we still go to consult with our different parliaments, but it is a view that was expressed very highly and positively in that summit. Now, coming to the tripartite free trade area, this one started the deepening of this regional integration has been for many years on Africa's agenda. And this involves both political and economic integration of member states in a linear fashion similar to the establishment of the European Union. So one of the recent actions to this regional integration arrangement is the establishment of the COMESA, EAC, SADC, and SADC tripartite, which actually was established very long ago in 2005. And it has 26 member states. So the core objective was to assist in meeting of Africa's Union broader objectives of continental economic integration and sustainable economic development. That is the main aim of the formation of this tripartite free trade area. Maybe just to go further and say, for instance, in 2011, the Tripartite Task Force reported on its progress on a range of areas that it has been tasked with, and this was taken so that the head of state at the first summit in particular, it noted that it had drafted a roadmap and prepared a draft agreement establishing the TFTA, as well as required annexes to that. And again, in June 2011, there was the official launch of the TFTA. And the, the, the,
also the second summit of the tripartite heads of state during this summit, agreed on principles on the negotiations of the roadmap and specific deadlines were put, and the institutional framework for negotiations is also put underway. Now, in June, not long ago, there was a formal official launching of the TMA, and 16 states have signed the agreement. However, the agreement will only be entered into force once the 14 states have ratified it. And there were also outstanding issues arising from phase one that had to be concluded by June 2016. The outstanding issues, for instance, include annexes on tariff liberalization, rules of origin of trade remedies, furthermore, the text on the movement of business people, which was being negotiated on separate and production, is being drafted. This, for instance, when we talk of movement of business people, we will also think of the immigration laws that our country, for instance, has, and how it will affect all those the objectives of this tripartite free trade area. So far, that's what I wanted to comment on. Thank you very much.
Yeah, honourable to your recent participation in the SADC, it clearly comes through. You know, it's really very fresh. And the honourable Barotto, the House Chair on International Relations, and she has brought you up to speed on very latest developments of what has happened there. And that's always very useful. But I think, you know, that continental free trade area really is important. It goes back over and over again to the principle of the suit that South Africa has of ensuring we become a real part of regional integration. Not just for any reason, but yes, we'll all get something out of it. There's a need to approach, we believe, a developmental approach, integrated approach, which combines trade, integration, and what we refer to several times, infrastructural development. That infrastructural development, I keep on coming back to, yes, we need engineers, we need expertise that we may not always have within our own countries here. It also calls for a much tighter coordinated sectoral policy, much tighter. And I think there's overdue. We've analyzed this, and there's been a realization that this linear type of approach cannot simply work in Africa. It's inadequate to address Africa's complex needs. Very first being a real lack of infrastructure, a very real lack, not resources, you know, but the lack of coordination and being able to develop this into infrastructure itself. And the other thing is that, of course, perhaps like Europe some years back, and perhaps even now, the member states, the continent, are on very different levels of development. So that, you know, you mentioned that Greece wasn't really collecting all these taxes or whatever, that was part of it. Well, the same thing occurs in countries in Africa. And in fact, one of the critical roles South Africa plays, and shares with her brothers and sisters, is our ability to collect revenue. I mean, it doesn't matter which party you are, I think they would agree. The capacity to collect revenue has firmly been systemized in our country. And also, people have been brought round over 10 years, and now 21 years later, to accept that you must contribute to the taxation process. You're part of that. And that's what we'd like to share with our brothers and sisters on the continent and so on. But the other thing is to move with, during this free trade, you know, agreement that we had, the tripartite alliance and some agreements, we want to pursue a complementarity approach with with manufacturing. You know, today, it's quite true, if you look at a Boeing, you look at anything, that very few countries produce the whole thing. You've got about 20 countries involved. You produce this little part, that little part, and the next. And that is part of this global value chain. And how does Africa participate effectively in that? At the same time, how does Europe come to the party? BRICS come to the party? And how do we get to the party, as it were, in your country? You know, I think that's very important as well. I think Honourable Watson spoke about access, you know, earlier on. And we come right back to that kind of thing. But this is not going to happen overnight. You know, but maybe my grandchildren who actually see this. But we certainly are making vast strides. One of the interesting things about trade in Africa, intra-African trade is the smallest, but it's the quality of the trade. The quality of the trade is actually higher value, and that's what's interesting about it. And we would certainly like to get our trading partners, and not just trading partners, but our strategic partners, politically, parliamentary-wise, to join us in, you know, developing our continent in this regard. That's on the sort of trade and economic side. And on the other side, you know yourselves throughout history, once you have peace and you bring in development, you can begin to lay the system on good governance. Good governance doesn't come out of conflict per se. It is a seed that has to be nurtured within the structures. And also the development of an institutional architectural capacity within our own country, but also within other countries in Africa. I think one of our biggest challenges has been the need to develop institutional memory in Parliament. If I look around me, I can guarantee no MP will disagree with that. We've got to establish a sound institutional memory. You know, when we have got to actually ensure that we have competent, professional, and committed, and capacitated staff to support us, but also the parliamentarians themselves. You know, you are not elected because you can operate an ICT system. Of course we know that. We know that. But if you can't, if you can't operate in this modern age, you haven't. Absolutely haven't. So we need, people have come from a different mode of work, as it were, including myself, you know, the shift from a sort of Olivetti typewriter to the most modern system. And I remember losing my first master's thesis because I thought, if I put in a layout and did this and that, and please put this format in, format meant how the pages laid out. Only to learn that format meant deletion totally of 300 pages of dissertation. So, all of us, and I use that as an illustration of what can happen in Parliament. We dare not lose our information. But how do we store it effectively for access to be of use to all members of Parliament and our institutional memory? And that's part of regional integration and sharing, very much part of that. So it's not only concrete, etc., but it is also that. And the other thing about regional integration is a huge issue in our country, not in yours, not in the European Union, and that is telecommunications. Today, as we talk, countries in Africa have to go to the Paris Exchange to call South Africa. You know, we have these anomalies here. Huge gaps in this sort of area. And the barriers and customs, when I say barriers, I'm not talking of a physical barrier. You yourself came about through watching one customs union. And you know that that means the ease of business and the massive acceleration of business in Europe. We do know that we have got to overcome these technical challenges with respect to customs, respect to administration, communication, and transport infrastructure. So that's, you know, a great future for the European Union. I see a great future in Africa, and a great future globally of West meeting East, because it's no longer going to be an artificial meeting. It's going to be a more inclusive sharing of experience and expertise to provide a better life for all our peoples. Over to you, thank you, Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mrs. Phelps. Let me say the following, then give the floor to Mr. Borelli and Mrs. Baylor on the topic. Regional integration cooperation is key. What we see in Europe, that the French, before the Brits came in, were the politically dominant power, and the Germans put their economic weight in, and the other countries accepted it. In Southern Africa, you see that, as I see it, I may be not correct, South Africa is politically extremely important, some will call it dominant. But also from the economic side, you are a dominant power in Southern Africa. And what I hope is that you're able to prevent what we have not been able to prevent today, that Germany, which means well, I think, has now become politically dominant, economically dominant, and so the others in the European Union focus also against Germany. So we always need a balance in the cooperation and the integration. So I hope that you can prevent that your country having this political position and economic position unite the region, not with you, but against you. I don't say that you want this, I believe that you absolutely do not want that, but it is an issue which you should take care of for the benefit of the region as such. I would like to introduce Mr. Borelli and to Mrs. Pierre, they have requested for that, maybe others want to do. Mr. Borelli,
thank you, Chairman. South Africa is the European Union's largest trading partner in Africa, and you are a gateway to trade to other countries in this region. But your pivotal role is not only for economical reasons. In the past years, you were engaged in several mediation and conflict resolution operations in this continent. You are in the BRICS, you are in the G20, you are an interlocutor for China and Russia. South Africa has a central political and trade role in this region, but Kenya, Tanzania, Nigeria are growing and they are expanding their markets. They are trying to position themselves as regional hubs, and I think you need to react increasing efforts for regional integration. You have to use business diplomacy to gain the position you deserve, but you need also to invest more in skills and attract foreign investment, ensuring political stability. In my opinion, you need to enlarge an attractive policy for investors. I mean the condition, taxes and services for entrepreneurs that decide to come here to enter the African market. About the tripartite project, I want to focus on at one point. Regional integration, like we said before, is not only a free trade of goods and services. You need to share political views like trade policy, defense policy, fiscal policy, and so on. In Europe, we choose to share currency and goods before political issues. And now we are facing some problems. So I think that you need to take your time and get along step by step.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's quite interesting to look at regional
on what is a region. I think Europe's, South African's or African's view of what is Europe is as confused as probably Europeans is as what is the South African region. I mean, you know, where do? We stop at Ukraine or go further? And for you, I think it's, you know, how far north do you go, Botswana, Malawi even, and Namibia, Botswana, Angola, Mozambique, clearly you've got Swaziland and the sugar is part of your sphere. But within any block, you will get people movement, you will get animal movement, especially here in Africa where you have some of the finest parts on the planet, and of course the trade movement. One of the portfolios that I'm looking on at the moment is air quality. You have air movement even that moves around that may well lead regulation to make sure that one country is not polluting another one, that you have legislation on animal on people movement and the rest, as well as trade. You also need stability. And I think we in Europe are looking, holding our breath, looking at Zimbabwe and what might be going to be happening there when the inevitable and the Green Reaper finally comes for him. He's putting him quite well so far, but you know, everything happens. Nobody can avoid that. And what is the likely scenario for Zimbabwe? And how will South Africa's role be in maintaining peace and helping to solve that problem? Swaziland also is having its problems, I understand. I think one of the other things that certainly I and a lot of other Europeans look at, and in some way it's a result of the way that we have dealt with Africa, but I am always saddened by the low level of African trade that is taking place. It should be your immediate market between all African states, and yet there is this continual drive to export to Europe or the Americas and to buy from there, and it seems to me a huge missed opportunity that doesn't happen more than you're doing, and of course it comes down to infrastructure. The roads and rail networks need to be sufficiently reliable to do good trade. But the more you become integrated, I think the lessons that we've learned from Europe is the more it gets mighty complicated. You know, if you're selling jam across the border, who decides what jam is? You know, is it cutters or is it you know, all sugar in one country? And then we have the other complication. We have many different rules of taxation across Europe. We now have, if you are a gay couple in the UK, you can marry and in some of the other states, but not in others, where it's not even recognised, and you have discrimination in some countries. And the sizes of things, the shapes of things, the judgments you make, if you die in another country, whose rule is this law is supreme in when you're inheriting. All those sorts of things are the consequences of closer and closer union, and that is something I think you need to be looking at as you go. I mean, we certainly have the solid in Europe. We are attempting to, and our daily bread in the Parliament is trying to get our heads around these nitty-gritty issues. We've gone further down there, but I think we are looking at Africa and encouraging you to do more local networking and building up those networks, because you know the whatever happens in the rest of the world, you can't geographically move away from your neighbours. You need to be on good friends with them. Whatever happens to Europe, you're going to still have your next door neighbours there, so you need to be working well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hedrick. Are others want to come in from our side? If not, I return to you.
I'd like to ask our Chair of International Relations, the Honourable Arutu, to come in here again. She started the process.
So in the lecture, as I was listening to Madame, they're talking about local networks and Africa trade, that we should try and help one another. I just like to say that from the Islamic Parliamentary Forum that we had, one of the presenters came with this notion that we should kill geography. And just on a lighter note, and that means when you kill geography, it means you don't have to demarcate your borders and your countries and so on. I'm just on a lighter note, I like to say that. Thank you.
You're quite right. We need, I mean, at this time of graveyard shift, a little lightness to help me, I think. But, you know, I'm sure in Europe as well, you know, we started off this morning and, you know, getting into the oversight role of Parliament and shifting off into issues like development plans of one kind and another, yours, ours, moving into human rights, migration, extremism, and so on, integrity of Europe, financial issues. And when you look at all that, and someone, I think, perhaps it was the Honourable Mackay, spoke about economic reasons sometimes providing pressure for migration, but also others, of course. And Europe went through that. When you think of it, from the Merovingian to the Carolingian kingdoms, you know, I mean, that so-called map was transformed in Europe, rewritten as it were, and arguably, one could say, you had a similar problem to what we have in Africa, where artificial borders were created. We have the same thing. And because of artificial borders, that sometimes leads to unrest, conflict, and so on. But in the final analysis, we do need to rise above that. There are certain realities which will not be changed in our lifetime, as it were. So how best can we work together? We keep on saying that. How do we manage the challenges that are before both our parliaments? Because we are that critical arm of government. We are of the state, the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. And Parliament plays a critical role in that. And we've seen where there is a sound Parliament that reflects and is the voice of the people, more than likely you've got good governance. Things work out if it's robust. And that, I think, is what we are both striving, I believe, to reach, although we may have differences of opinion a long way. But I really want to just head over to my co-chair before I finally adjourn the meeting. Honourable Van Barnen.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fels. I must say that from our side, from the European side, we really like this way of discussion. It's open, there are no taboos, and we say what we want to say. This is important because we share a long history with white pages and black pages. And the best thing is that to engage. I think that if you look at the topics we discussed, we should go next time when you are in Europe more into depth, more into detail, bureaucratic detail. We should work out the ideas so we can set an extra step. The same we can do by making a kind of statement, but that will always be a general one. But let's continue to work on these topics because I agree with you that if parliaments work well, the countries do well as well. Thank you very much.
Well, there we are. We've had a constructive day. I'm not sure what the Cape weather holds for you, because you can get 5 clients in one day. And but we are sure that staff would have arranged. And we will start off tomorrow with introductions of the staff as well, who play an invaluable role in the sort of dialogue, discussion, debate, and meeting. But tomorrow morning, when we look at the Friday, I was asked at one point by Ambassador to consider, you know, if it was possible, not to compromise our talks and discussions, but if it was possible to find free up the afternoon, as it were. And I think by and large, we have been able to do that. You will see that we expect to have lunch ready at about 12, even earlier, if we work constructively together. And you should be able to go, and, you know, in the month of Mandela, I believe you wanted to visit an island or some other such places, where our iconic late president, Tata Madiba, was requested to be incarcerated. We could then say our farewells round about 1:30 or so. That's how I see it panning out for the full co-chair. And at early start, we would immediately start, as I see it, at 9:15 tomorrow, if that's all right. But right now, I believe we can perform it to a cocktail function hosted by the European Union. I don't know quite what that means, European Union. I'm sure that's exactly where it should stop. And the venue, the venue is the Taj Hotel. Thank you very much.